Starting this Thursday, Cincinnati Opera presents a series of performances of a wise and witty comedy that is as fresh today as it was at its premiere in 1652. I'm Evans Marajas, the Harry T. Wilkes Artistic Director for Cincinnati Opera. I invite you to join me for the next hour as we explore Cavalli's La Callisto, one of the very first commercially successful operas from that exciting time when opera was a brand new art form. And speaking of brand new, this music is from the very earliest opera that is still performed today. The grand and glorious noise that is the opening fanfare to Monteverdi's opera Orfeo, the earliest opera that is still performed today, written in 1600. Claudio Monteverdi was a mentor and teacher to Francesco Cavalli, his worthy successor as an opera composer. It is Cavalli's rollicking comedy, La Callisto, that Cincinnati Opera presents for five performances between July 17th and 27th in the Corbett Theater at the School for the Creative and Performing Arts. This is the first time in our 94-year history that we present a Baroque opera. And so we've assembled a cast and a creative team whose passion for this opera and Baroque music in general is palpable. Among them is our conductor, the Englishman David Bates, making his U.S. debut with these performances. He's my co-host, and he begins by giving us an insight on how the operas of Cavalli marked a new chapter in the still new art form of opera in the middle 1600s.
Opera in the early 17th century is a courtly event. It's for the well-to-do society. It's not for the individual. It's not for the man on the street. But through the first 50 years of that century, it starts to become so. It's thanks to the likes of Cavalli. Cavalli really that sets it up as a commercial enterprise.
And Cavalli's music is full of an urgency and energy that jumps off the page, even after 350 years. Instrumental music from Francesco Cavalli's opera La Callisto. As David Bates mentioned, until the 1630s, opera was made primarily for the aristocracy and performed in their palaces and private theaters. But as Venice was progressive in so many of the arts of the Renaissance and Baroque, and the musical center of Italy at this time, it was Venetian composers and producers of theater who turned opera into a public entertainment. From this historical perspective, it seems like one of those moments in history when it simply all came together, in the right place, at the right time. The greatest composer of his age, Claudio Monteverdi, was the master of music for St. Mark's Basilica in Venice and the pioneering opera composer. His energy flowed into his pupils, none more so than Francesco Cavalli. Cavalli was from a small town called Crema, not far from Milan. His name at birth was Francesco Caletti, and he came from a musical family. By the age of 12, his musical talent caught the eye of the Venetian governor of Crema named Federico Cavalli. So young Mr. Caletti was invited to travel to Venice to seek his fortune in music, sponsored by Governor Cavalli. So grateful was our young musician from Crema that he took the name of his patron. And for the rest of his life, our composer was known as Francesco Cavalli. He rose quickly in the heady world of Venetian music making, and by the age of 14 was employed by St. Mark's Cathedral and its masterful music director, Claudio Monteverdi. Though he would achieve his greatest fame as a composer of operas, Cavalli also wrote a great deal of beautiful sacred music, no doubt influenced by his mentor, Monteverdi. This is Cavalli's Magnificat. Magnificat by Francesco Cavalli. This composer from the little town of Crema, not far from Milan, would become the first wildly successful composer of opera for public theaters, working in what might be called the Broadway of the 17th century, the city of Venice. By the middle of that century, over a dozen opera houses were operating in Venice, and Cavalli would become the most sought-after composer of operas for them. Cincinnati Opera will present Cavalli's La Callisto for 5 performances beginning this Thursday and running to the end of July. Why did opera so quickly establish itself as the most popular public entertainment of its day? Our conductor of La Callisto, David Bates, explains.
There's an intrinsic sense of drama, mainly that they take their stories from Greek tragedy, which of course is the oldest expression of theatre. So in a sense, they were onto a winner from the word go, because the stories that they're adopting are exceptionally theatrical. You know, and what does theatre mean? It's the contrast of two different moods. So at once you have high tragedy, high drama, someone's going to kill someone or kill themselves. What's the next scene? Complete buffo, complete joke, complete laughing, drunkenness. And I suppose, why does the audience latch onto that? I suppose it's eternal. It's how our lives run today. Perhaps not in quite such magnification, but you know, I certainly lurch from one wonderful thing to then something that doesn't go quite so well. You know, it's a human instinct. I'm sure that's why things took off so quickly.
Cavalli's La Callisto is filled with these wonderful contrasts, and we'll take a tour through the opera in a moment. But to set the stage for this sound world, this is one of the beautiful arias from La Callisto sung by the title character. Callisto is lamenting that the earth has been rendered a wasteland after the cataclysm of Phaeton flying too close to the sun. Aria Piante Ombrose from La Callisto, sung by the title character. What's fascinating to me is that so much of what we love about opera is present from the very beginnings of the art form. As you just heard, the song, or aria, very quickly established itself as an important part of the storytelling of opera. What Monteverdi, the pioneer, wanted to do was to recreate the sound world of ancient Greek drama for modern ears. He and his contemporaries started by following the ancient writings recently rediscovered, which told of how the dramas alternated between speaking and singing. There was also dancing, instrumental music, and elaborate theatrical effects. So, the very earliest operas were mostly speech elevated to melody, but not quite arias. This early form of what we now call recitative is incredibly beautiful, as this excerpt from Monteverdi's Orfeo will show. It's the hero's apostrophe to his beloved towards the beginning of the opera.
Circondi il tutto lì, dagli stellanti giri, dimmi, vedesti mai di me più liete fortunato amante? Fu ben felice il giorno, mio ben, che pria ti vidi. E più felice l'ora che per te sospirai, poiché il mio sospirar tu sospirasti. Felicissimo il punto che la candida mano pegno di pura a me porgesti, se tanti cori avessi, quanto chi il cielo eterno, e quante chiome anch'esti, colli a me il verde maggio, tutti colmi sarie, noi traboccanti di quel piacer che oggi mi fa.
Music from Monteverdi's Orfeo, an example of the vocal style when opera was brand new. By the time we get to Cavalli's La Callisto, written in 1652, the aria as we know it was becoming established. It wasn't the show-stopping showcase it would become in the operas of Handel, let's say, but it was already a vehicle that allowed the character to pause and reflect. The beauty of Cavalli's genius was that he created a musical structure that had recitative, which is the musical equivalent of dialogue, flowing into and out of arias. What this does is create an opera that seamlessly moves between action and repose. This is one of those exquisite moments from La Callisto.
Amate nelle memorie mie, le
the aria and recitative Restino Imbalsamate from Cavalli's opera La Callisto, sung by the title character. It's a wonderful example of an early form of the aria that flows into and out of melody, alternating with sung speech, or, as we call it now, recitative. In order for us to create our first Baroque opera at Cincinnati Opera, we turned to several experts in this field so that both our dramatic and musical presentation would stay as faithful as possible to the original intentions of the composer. Nowadays, the world is filled with great musicians who make a specialty in making this music come to life vibrantly for modern ears. Here in Cincinnati, we're lucky to have the Catacoustic Consort and its artistic director, Annalisa Pappano. Annalisa is no stranger to WGUC listeners, as the consort's concerts are regularly broadcast. Now, the consort provides the core of our La Callisto Orchestra, collaborating with members of the Cincinnati Symphony. What these catacousticians bring to the party, so to speak, are those plucked and bowed instruments unique to early music, with beautiful names like chitarrone, lirone, and viola da gamba. Here is Annalisa Pappano with some of her catacoustic colleages playing variations on an Italian madrigal called Ancor che col partite. Variations on the Italian madrigal Ancor che col partite by Riccardo Rognoni. It was played there by Annalisa Pappano and members of the Catacoustic Consort. Cincinnati's catacousticians form the core of the specialized Baroque orchestra, which combines with members of the Cincinnati Symphony to create the hauntingly beautiful Baroque sound palette for our first ever Baroque opera presentation. It is Cavalli's La Callisto. I'm Evans Mirages, the Harry T. Wilkes Artistic Director for Cincinnati Opera, and we're exploring the unique sound world of Baroque opera as Cincinnati Opera prepares to present Cavalli's La Callisto starting this Thursday, July 17th, for five performances. Leading our musical forces is the English conductor David Bates, making his United States debut with these performances. At home in England, he is the artistic director of the chorus and orchestra known as La Nuova Musica, an ensemble already gaining international attention and a prestigious exclusive recording contract with Harmonia Mundi Discs. David is so passionate about the Italian Baroque literature that even the name of his orchestra is derived from a famous book by an early Italian composer. He tells us how and why he started La Nuova Musica.
I was looking to my English colleagues, and really with the period performance practice, if you're a theorba player, you go to the Weiss treaties, or you go to a treaty that, you know, that was written in the day. Singers sort of don't sort of pick up as they go, they're sort of magpies. They sort of pick up as they go. They pick up little ornaments here and there. They might hear a cornetto doing a little noodle, and they might sort of pick it up. But actually, there's a great deal written about vocal performance practice from the very beginning of the 17th century, of commentators in the day listening to the singers, what they're doing, and then actually writing down specifics. And I was very aware that the people around me in these operas would just not... It wasn't that they weren't interested in what was being written, but they weren't aware. So I decided to put my energies to trying to communicate that to my fellow singers. The main source, the most famous one, I suppose, is a treatise by Caccini, written in 1602, Le Nuove Musiche.
This is the famous Caccini of Amarilli.
Amarilli Mia Bella. Right. Yeah, exactly. And so in that treatise, he wrote 12 songs, one of which was Amarilli. And he was very specific in how you execute that through feeling and through vocal execution.
Thank you.
the song Amarilli by Giulio Caccini, one of the oldest Italian songs published in 1602. It was sung there by Cecilia Bartoli. Caccini's pioneering treatise on how to perform music inspired conductor David Bates to name his chorus and orchestra La Nuova Musica, after Caccini's treatise. As a matter of fact, David Bates, who is our conductor for La Callisto, is deeply passionate about Italian music in general.
All Baroque music comes from the Italian school. People put a French slant on it, or an English slant on it, or a German slant, but it all comes up from Italy.
Well, it's no surprise that when young Mr. Handel wanted to further himself as a composer, he got himself out of Hamburg as quickly as he could and went to Italy.
Exactly, straight to Rome. Yeah. And actually, I mean, he was a real, real mover and shaker because, of course, he identified the biggest patrons immediately, Otto Boni and these people. And he got right into that little circle very quickly. And I don't know whether you know his setting of Dixit Dominus is just... It has the rigour of the German school in terms of the counterpoint and harmony, but the absolute incredible virtuosity and flamboyance of those Italian singers that he would have met.
Dixit, 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 Dix
the opening movement, to Handel's virtuoso cantata, Dixit Dominus, one of the many works the young Handel wrote in Rome while he was absorbing the unique Italian style of music we now call Baroque. It was performed there by La Nuova Musica, conducted by its founder, David Bates. Mr. David Bates is the conductor of our Cincinnati Opera first ever Baroque production, Cavalli's La Callisto. It opens this Thursday in the School for Creative and Performing Arts Corbett Auditorium. So let's take a brief tour through La Callisto. Like many of the early operas, the story of La Callisto was derived from the mythology of ancient Greece and Rome. For La Callisto, Cavalli worked with his frequent libretto collaborator, Giovanni Faustini. Cavalli and Faustini wrote 11 operas together, and as a matter of fact, at one point they were business partners running one of the many Venetian opera houses. Even at this early stage of opera as an art form, composers and librettists were listening to what the public wanted. And what the Venetian public wanted was variety, a bit of scandal, and fast-paced drama. So Faustini took the basic story of La Callisto and spiced it up. In doing so, when you come to see La Callisto, you may be reminded of the great comedies of Shakespeare, where there are noble characters, with mostly lofty ideals, and regular folks. In Shakespeare, they're called the rustics. The stories of both the nobles and the common folk comment on one another and rapidly alternate. And so it is with La Callisto. The overarching story is how the beautiful Callisto, a follower of the chaste goddess Diana, became one of the most beautiful constellations in heaven. We now call her Ursa Major. The way Faustini and Cavalli tell the story, there are also lovesick gods and demigods, sexually crazy satyrs, and a very old virgin who desperately wants to find a husband. This stew of plot lines makes for a comedy that is both hilarious, a bit naughty, and ultimately very touching. The story begins with a disaster. Phaeton has flown too close to the sun, and to prevent the destruction of the universe, Jove hurled a thunderbolt and Phaeton's chariot plunged to the earth, scorching the landscape and depriving the earth of water. Jove has now come down from Mount Olympus to repair the damage and also to satisfy his ever-wandering eye with a new amorous conquest among us mere mortals. Cavalli sets the desolate scene with an atmospheric short overture. It doesn't take long for Jove to lay his eyes on the beautiful nymph Callisto. She spurns his advances. What is Jove to do? Well, his sidekick, the god Mercury, has an idea. Jove should disguise himself as Diana, goddess of the hunt. Callisto is one of her followers, and she cannot resist her goddess. So Jove does just that, instantly turning himself into Diana in appearance and hilariously in voice, singing in falsetto. Here is our great masculine god's attempt to sound like a girl. Callisto falls for it, and they go off into the bushes, and they engage in some not-so-chaste kissing games.
Yeah.
The scene from La Callisto, where Jove impersonates Diana to seduce the virtuous Callisto. Well, things quickly take a turn for the worse for our poor heroine. She is still in a bit of a daze from her encounter with what she thinks is her goddess. And then the real Diana comes onto the scene. Callisto wants to take up where they left off. And now the genuine goddess is furious. She denounces Callisto and banishes her from her cohort of huntresses. Now, I have to tell you, Diana is not as pure as one might imagine. She is secretly in love with the mortal Endymion. But for the moment, she hides her passion. And just to make matters more complicated, Pan, the god of the satyrs, is also in love with Diana. He enters the drama with a passionate lament and a couple of his satyr buddies, decrying his inability to get Diana's attention.
Disperse lacere le chiome ad aria, in volti squallidi, sopra il cadavere del dio di Menalo, cantate flebili, cantate, cantate la mesta nenia. Amor, amor che un aspide con
risuscita sconsolato e scaccia il tormino, la tua diva il petto morbido nella fe serpe pestifera, al tuo bene salutifera la speranza ancora suscita.
Risuscita, 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 risuscita.
Risuscita, 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 risuscita,
risuscita.
Conforti deboli sono i vostri, implacabile e fiera vipera, a miei preghi e fatalia. Ne rammentasi del bel don di lane candide che la fe scendere dal suo giro lucido, vezzosa e fulgida, a baciarmi in labbro rigido. Io temo, temo e dubito, che da gote più piacevoli, più vaghe e morbide, colga il mio. Singulti amari e queruli, mi stempro l'anima.
Se esplorisi investiti di questa tua ruvida l'amore che immagini, quel vago che rubati al cuore ogni giubilo, in braccio alla perfida, squartandolo girasi.
Io per proprio amorosi cenide, io per grazie mio dietro.
soccorso chiedoti e fa che in braccio torni al mio giaccio, fallo de pregoti e fa che in braccio torni al mio giaccio, fallo de pregoti.
Pane, consolati chi letto morbido di fiori, il torbido svanì. Svanir, svanir, vedremo te. Pane, pane, poi fremiti da morte, da morte,
da morte,
da morte.
The scene Numi Selvatici from Cavalli's La Callisto, where Pan decries his ability to get the attention of the goddess Diana. In Act Two, we meet Mrs. Jove, and she's not at all pleased that her philandering husband is at it again. She is, of course, Juno, and she has one of the greatest stage directions in all of opera for her entrance. In the score, it reads, I quote, "Juno descends to the earth in a chariot drawn by flying peacocks." Her first music may remind you of the many vengeance arias in later operas where the wronged woman vents her fury. This one's a real firecracker. That's one rather angry wife. Juno's entrance aria from La Callisto. The trouble with Juno is that she has godly powers, and she seeks revenge for her husband's latest amorous adventure. She finds the now totally bewildered Callisto and confronts her. Now, why is Juno punishing the innocent victim and not her husband directly? Perhaps Juno feels she can only affect her god/husband by taking away the objects of his affection? The punishment she chooses for Callisto is particularly cruel. Juno turns Callisto into a bear. Juno returns to heaven satisfied and leaves us with an aria in which she cautions all wives mortal or immortal, to beware. If your husband comes to bed tired and exhausted, it's a sure sign he's expending his amorous energies elsewhere. The exit aria for the goddess Juno in Cavalli's La Callisto. Juno has punished the mortal girl Callisto, whom she suspects of having an affair with her husband, the god Jove. It isn't true, but such is the sometimes arbitrary way the gods intervene in the lives of us mere mortals. The story has a bittersweet ending. Diana decides to accept her love for Endymion, and she rescues him from captivity. Jove is sorry for the fate of Callisto, and though he is a god, he cannot completely undo the curse his wife has placed on Callisto. While the innocent girl is alive, she must wander the earth as a bear. But Jove will see that she is protected and assigns the god Mercury to follow her wherever she goes. Furthermore, when she dies, she will ascend into the heavens and forevermore glow in the night sky. This is how we get our beautiful constellation, Ursa Major, or the Big Bear. Jove takes Callisto briefly into the heavens to show her what awaits, and Cavalli writes a beautiful ensemble depicting the delights of heaven. The final scene of La Callisto, wherein our heroine, Callisto, is shown the heavenly sphere she will inhabit after her time on Earth is over. This week, starting on Thursday, July the 17th, Cincinnati Opera presents five performances of La Callisto in the intimate setting of the Corbett Theater of the School for Creative and Performing Arts. As I hope you have discovered with me in the last hour, this opera, even though it was written in 1652, at the dawn of the art form, already has all we love about opera. Beautiful melodies, comedy, and at the heart of it all, a story with heart and soul. Equally important, as our conductor David Bates points out, it is a theatrical experience, elevated by music.
You need to just reset your calibration. You need to reset your sense that you're coming to see a piece of theatre, that you're not coming to see grand opera, you're coming to see a piece of theatre, you're coming to see a story being told with some wild, interesting, wonderful, colourful characters, and let them take you on the journey. It's not about orchestral colours, a palette. It's about theatre and the directness of this story being told.
Presto il fato v'unirà.
Vado giove.
Oh, bella.
Vado giove.
Oh, bella.
Vado giove.
Oh, bella.
My thanks to producer Bruce Ellis. For WGUC, I'm Evans Mirages.